Web Talk Radio is brought to you by Web.com, the most trusted name on the net. When you're ready to get on the web, visit Web.com for domain names as low as $4.95. Web.com offers full-featured web hosting, including online store packages, starting at only $7.95 per month. Web.com has thousands of .web.com names available at www.web.com. WebTalk is also brought to you by Replay Radio at replay-radio.com. It turns your PC into a sophisticated web radio VCR. It's a great way to enjoy listening to the radio. Record your favorite music and radio shows and stations, and then listen anywhere and whenever you want on any device you want. Get the free trial download at replay-radio.com.
This is Web Talk at WebTalkRadio.com, and thank you for joining us from around the world, and you're listening to the Internet's Future, and I'm Rob Greenlee.
Rob, hi there. This is Dana. We're both here once again every week, waiting to bring you some good tech news. And on the show this week,
trends in wearable computing and the bionic brain.
Technology and databases radically transformed the 2004 presidential campaign.
AOL's public portal may be coming soon.
And digging into our digital mailbag, we hear from three great, smart listeners. One that's developed a new browser, another that builds a new social networking website, and we hear from DocTom.com. It's pretty exciting when you talk about the future and you figure out what's going to be ahead as far as technology goes. Like, for instance, if you ever wondered about when it'll be you'll be wearing a computer, or exactly how it will be when you download your entire brain. Well, these are the kind of things that not only thrill me, but also thrill the founder of Futurist.com. Glenn Heemstra is a good friend of the show. He's been on before, and he's not only a futurist. He's a visiting scholar at the Human Interface Technology Lab at the University of Washington. And he was actually a consultant on that futuristic show that was on a few months ago called Century City. We liked it. It was a good show. We cornered him to tell us his thoughts on future trends, such as the coming wearable computer.
George Washington does an annual Delphi study of scientists and technologists, asking them to make forecasts, and one of the forecasts they asked them to make were the top 10 consumer products in the year 2010. And among the top 10 were wearable computers.
We all have seen the changes that have happened over the last year to the presidential campaign based on the use of the internet and the web, and the way politicians have been able to raise money and reach voters at a very grassroots level and use technology like wireless network databases are making the 2004 presidential campaign go high-tech with terms like CRM and micro-targeting. And they're reaching voters using regional and local data to better craft the campaign message. Business 2.0 magazine columnist John Heilman will join us to talk about how technology and the internet will continue to impact the presidential elections of 2004 and the high-tech political arms race that will be set into motion.
These guys are using the abilities of the data mining technologies and the web to be able to, you know, take this political process to this very exquisitely finely tuned, intensely targeted mode of political communication and persuasion.
Before we get to those wonderful conversations, I want to take a quick look at the news this week. Rob, AOL has done a few things that you think are kind of signaling a change.
They seem to be talking about the possibility of making a lot more of their content available to the public and actually competing directly with like Yahoo and the MSN folks and offering a web portal. Now, this isn't something that they're going to be doing anytime soon. They're still going to be offering a page that's only available to their subscribers for now, but there is talk that that page could become more and more public over the coming year or so, as they try and gather online advertising revenue as a source of revenue for them as they are seeing their subscriber numbers decline. So they're looking for alternative revenue here. They're also firing up their Netscape subsidiary. So you might see the Netscape browser show up again on the scene as a tool that AOL wields on the web.
Rob, I wanted to dig into the digital mailbag because we got several good emails this week. Why don't you read us the first one?
We got an email from Kelly Campen, and he said he loves our show and he thinks it's great about how we give the little guys a chance to talk on our show. And I think he's probably talking about the David Peterson interview that we had on last week, a 13-year-old web developer. And he's really curious about what we think about social networking sites and the revolution that seems to be happening out there. And he has a special interest in that because he just built a kind of a social networking related site all out of PHP. It's at isocialite.com. And this is the very first project that he's taken on. And I think it's very cool that there's a lot of people out there still doing creative things with the web and the internet. And certainly if you want to give some feedback to Kelly about his website, and go check it out. And he actually grew up just a few miles away from the Web Talk Radio studio and used to own a company called NoPay.net, which was a free ISP. And I used to work for a free ISP years ago.
Yeah, freeinternet.com. Where are they now?
Nowhere.
So that's isocialite.com. Also, we heard from Tom Ferguson. He lives in Austin, Texas. He's very interesting. He's a doctor. He's been online since the early 90s, particularly concerned and interested in online health on the internet. But his current job is Senior Research Fellow for Online Health at the Pew Internet and American Life Project out of Washington, D.C.
And he's very cool.
Yeah. He's editor of the Ferguson Report. It's a newsletter for e-patients at fergusonreport.com. But I love the name of his weblog, and this is what he shared with us. It's he's a doctor, and his name's Tom, so it's doctom.com.
You said it. I can't believe it.
Can you say it?
Doctom.com.
I think you did it. Now say it three times in a row. I challenge any of you listening right now.
Doctom.com, doctom.com, doctom.com.
Exciting radio.
I just did it. It is.
Well, Tom also sent us a couple articles. I read them because they're about e-patients, and they're about – these articles are going to be published next month in the British Medical Journal. But what was interesting I pulled out of that, and I didn't realize this, that it's very popular to search out your symptoms and help and support for medical situations online, and it's the third most popular online activity.
Yeah, and almost half of the entire U.S. population has looked up health information on the net at some time or another, and I've done it, looking up for, you know, symptoms. I had an ache and pain somewhere, and I looked it up.
Well, Doc Tom also took Rob up on his offer. They wanted to join ORCID. That's a social networking group that he wanted to explore to see if they had maybe any solutions for people that have online or health concerns. They want to find support within this social networking
community. I'm sure that there's probably a community within ORCID that talks about health-related issues, and you can certainly post your questions there. And I get requests from people to join ORCID all the time. So if you want to join, just send me an email.
Invitation has to come from an existing member. It's very exclusive in
there. And that's at rob@webtalkguys.com.
Well, be sure and check out doctom.com. Rob, read the last email.
We got an email from Vincent Wilcox from England, and he's a regular listener to the show, and he's also a member of the ORCID community and a good guy. And he's been working on a project of his own. He's created a browser called Safe to Surf, and it's a browser that uses the IE technology. He's just kind of customized it, and he's added some extra features to the program. And one of them is to limit the sites and pages that children can see. You're certainly welcome to go visit his site, and we're going to put a link to it off of the front page of our website. He's launched a development forum, so you can give him feedback on any bugs that you find at it.
And that's at www.urgroup.info. But if you want to see the Safe to Surf browser and download it, it's at urgroup.info/safe2surf. So thank you very much, Vincent. Appreciate it. I feel like I know you, Vincent. I see your face all the time in ORCID.
That's right. That's right. I've seen Vincent a few times. Support for Web Talk every week is provided by Web.com, the most trusted name on the net. And when you're ready to get on the net, go check out Web.com. They've got some terrific website domains that you can get for as low as $4.95 a year and $7.95 for a website hosting.
Oh, and you have to go check out the other sponsor of our show. It's Replay Radio at replay-radio.com. Not only is that a phenomenal little piece of software where you can record radio programs from the internet and also from your regular radio and listen to them wherever you want, but they've got a new piece of software coming out. It's kind of a soft launch right now. It's called replay-music.com. Just go check that one out. That's pretty spectacular what it can do.
We also get support from the InfoCreek.com site, and they offer very cool, high-tech looking websites, and they're building our website. You can go check out our site at their portfolio page if you wanted to get a sneak peek.
Well, hang in there. You've listened to 9 minutes so far. There's a lot of good content coming up. Did you ever wonder what the future holds in regards to technology and how it's going to affect you, like nanotechnology or wireless connections to your brain? Well, I'm here to tell you, you don't have to wait 20 years to find out, because in two shakes, Futurist.com founder Glenn Hiemstra is with us. He's going to tell you his educated glimpse into your future.
He's got the crystal ball. This is Web Talk Radio.
Radio lovers, you can now record thousands of radio stations, listen anywhere you want, and even fast forward over the fluff. How? With Replay Radio. It's easy to use and incredibly cool. Replay Radio turns your PC into a VCR for the radio. To listen, just use your PC, MP3 player, iPod, or car CD player. So what are you waiting for? Try a free demo right now. Visit the Replay Radio website today at replay-radio.com.
This is Web Talk Radio, and thank you for joining us and listening today again. My name is Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee's here with me as well.
Well, Rob, talking about how the future, as far as technology goes, will affect us is very exciting. I mean, I wonder if we're going to have nanotechnology take over, or are we going to be able to download information right into our brain, or what about those wearable computers we keep hearing about? Well, I'm not the only one that's excited about it. Well, these are the kind of things that also thrill the founder of Futurist.com.
And that futurist is Glenn Hiemstra, and he's a good friend of the show. And not only is he a futurist, he's also a visiting scholar at the Human Interface Technology Lab at the University of Washington. He was also a consultant to the futuristic TV show called Century City. Today, we cornered him to tell us about his thoughts on the trends in wearable computing and the possibility of a bionic brain. Glenn, it's great to have you on the program with us again.
Hello, nice to be here again.
Let's talk a little bit about wearable computing. You've recently put some articles out talking about how the whole future of how we communicate with computers is going to be changing. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your glimpse into the future here on that area?
This is a topic that I have been paying attention to for some time.
Uh-huh.
It first began to appear, I suppose, in the mid-1990s with something out of MIT called the Wearable Computer Initiative,
mm-hmm.
in which they had people carrying big laptops strapped to their back and these weird-looking goggles and so on that they would wear. And the question was, would there come a day when we carry significant computing power around with us in things that we wear? The mm-hmm. Boeing company was interested in that. The military was interested in that. And then in the year 2000, George Washington University, which does an annual the Future Studies Program at George Washington does an annual Delphi study of scientists and technologists, asking them to make forecasts, and one of the forecasts they asked them to make were the top 10 consumer products in the year 2010.
Uh-huh.
This was in the year 2000. And among the top 10 were wearable computers. So that sparked my interest even more, and it was around that time that I became a visiting scholar at the HIT Lab at the University of Washington. That's mm-hmm. the Human Interface Technology Lab, which had been for 10 years previous studying virtual reality technology, augmented reality technology, and basically asking the question, how is it that human beings can interact more effectively with data through computers? So I've been paying attention to the academics and the researchers and so on who are studying this field, and what I see coming, and we've already begun really to see it in the last couple of years in some consumer products, are, first of all, more computing power built into devices small enough to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we wear them clipped onto our belts at this point or in our pockets, and they might be cell phones or
mm-hmm.
Personal digital assistants or pocket computers.
Smartphones, yeah. Those type of devices.
Smartphones, and so on. And that's the precursor of what we're really talking, I think, or what these folks are really talking about when they talk about wearable computers.
Mm-hmm.
There is a we have seen some sort of testing of products that might have a kind of keypad built into the sleeve that might operate a little bit of computing power somewhere in the garment. But literally what people expect, and I think it's a reasonable expectation, and 2010 might be a little optimistic, but it is, we have a few years to go before we're there, would be that a pair of glasses that you wear might enable you to view computerized data when you want to. In other words, act as an augmented reality device.
Okay.
Just this spring, Microvision, a company in Bothell, Washington, has started selling its commercial version of what they call Nomad, which is, it's actually their second edition now of a wearable mm-hmm. computer. Their target market is, as I understand it, the automobile repair industry. You wear a little computing device on your hip, and then you put on a baseball cap. And attached to the bill, underside of the bill of the baseball cap, are devices that enable a retinal display,
wow.
a virtual retinal display, to bounce off a little mirror-like device in front of one eye. So it beams a computerized image onto that little mirror, reflects off that mirror direct into your eye using a red laser.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a laser computer display painted onto your eyeball, basically.
Yeah, interesting.
It actually goes back to the back of your eye. And you can see computerized data. It's kind of like when you were looking through the point of view of the Terminator.
Uh-huh.
And the Terminator would look at a subject and he would get all kinds of readings in his eye. That's what this device does. And that they have prototypes of full-color versions of that, but right now the cheapest is to use just a red laser device. But if you remember, the original Game Boys were only in red.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Then they became in color. So the miniaturization of computing power, and particularly the miniaturization of storage devices, the ability to do virtual retinal display right painted right over the eye using smaller and smaller devices. And then there's one other technology that applies. There's probably several others, but one other one that comes to mind is the flexible polymer kind of computer mm-hmm. screens, the light-emitting diodes that can be integrated into a flexible polymer screen, and there's some initial consumer products coming out with that.
So it's
kind of like computer. It's like a paper made out of fabric, although it's really a plastic. It's a polymer,
mm-hmm.
so that things could get more flexible and obviously more powerful. And then one would begin to ask, well, if you could have that much computing power built into a flexible wearable device, would we use them? So, and I think that starting with certain kind of industrial-like uses, like automobile repair people, the purpose of this particular Microvision device is to relieve them of the necessity of working on an engine, running over to the computer screen, looking at an instruction or a diagram, running back to the engine, doing some more work, running back to the computer screen.
Sure.
All that back and forth stuff gets taken care of by wearing this device.
Mm-hmm. Well, now all these types of devices are going to need to have some way for us to input into them. And I know we're all using mouses and keyboards these days. And are those ways of getting data into a computer going to kind of disappear over the next 10 or 15 years and there's going to be a new alternative way of doing it? Is it all going to be voice? Is it going to be – what are the types of things
debate,
you think?
There is debate about keyboards and mouse-like devices and how long they will last.
Mm-hmm.
My own opinion is that they will still last a long time,
mm-hmm.
that they will still be a primary way, particularly when you sit down at a computer, a desktop, laptop, whatever,
mm-hmm.
to input. But when you're using a portable device, of course, that becomes not realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, look at how we navigate around on cell phones using a little keypad or a little stylus.
Sure.
And that seems quite logical. At the lab at which I'm a visiting scholar, one of the things they have worked on, and other labs have as well, are gesture-based computing, where the screen itself is intelligent. It might have some cameras built into it so that it can see your hand making gestures.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can navigate around what would look like a typical, pretty typical desktop kind of screen just by gesturing at the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of research going on in that, and that seems quite a realistic one. And then there is a belief that continuous speech, natural language, voice recognition will become possible commercial
mm-hmm.
at a commercial level, you know, by the end of this decade, so that we will have devices that we can gesture at and speak to call up different functions, to tell it to do different things. Right now, the way that the Nomad device from Microvision works, as I understand it, is you actually reach down to this little hip-side computer, and you can navigate on there, like using your finger as a little mouse, just like with a touchpad kind of thing. But that seems like it will go away. The voice recognition to me is key. I go back and forth on that. I frequently think it would be awfully nice to have robust, natural speech, continuous speech, voice recognition when I'm alone with my computing device, when I'm in a crowd and imagining that crowd all talking to their computing device.
Yeah, that's not going to work. Yeah.
It might work. I mean, you might be able to get directional enough sound and so on that you could talk only to your computer, but the cacophony of sound seems like that would be a little bit daunting. So I'm not sure exactly how that will play out in sort of real-life public applications. But people believe that the software hardware will be capable enough within by the end of the decade to pull that off.
Glenn, I just get so excited listening to you talk. Since you mentioned voice recognition, of course, I think of Ray Kurzweil, the father of, and you actually have some thoughts, and you've talked before about what he's working on. We only have a minute left,
yes.
But if you could just give us an idea about his whole downloadable brain idea.
Recently, I had a chance to be a technical advisor, which is to say I got to sit for half of a day with the writers of a television series which came and went very fast in the last month. It was called Century City.
Oh, yeah,
which
yeah.
Which was the law firm in Los Angeles set in the year 2030. And we
actually thought it was a good TV show.
I thought they had some good story ideas, and some of them were ones that we talked about. I don't know if they were original to me in terms of the writers hearing them, but we talked about them, and one of them was being able to download your brain. As we get better at reading what's going on in the brain using various kinds of nanotechnology, biotechnology, and scanning devices, will it be possible, one can ask, to download a sort of neurochemistry, biochemistry snapshot of your brain at a particular point in time and have it in some senses be intelligent. Now, Ray Kurzweil says, yeah, that's going to come. The last I heard, the date he puts on that is the 2020s, 2030s, maybe later. But he believes absolutely that that's going to become possible. The story idea we came up with, I don't know that they did this story because they only showed a few of the 8 episodes that they filmed, was what would happen if your spouse died but you had downloaded their brain?
Yeah.
Would they in fact be dead? Could you get a death certificate? What would happen with insurance?
Yeah, interesting.
And all of that. If
all sorts
you
of
have
issues.
An urn, if you have an urn of their ashes on the desk, oh, by the way, a little hard drive there that has their brain still functioning. Are they dead or not?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And also, when you start thinking about having a computer chip in your brain, it really opens the possibility of being able to connect to the internet or a network and get direct information right off of the internet, right into your brain.
Yeah. See, Kurzweil takes it that step, too. He believes that we will see a merger of what he calls biological intelligence, i.e. us, and silicon intelligence, or computers that will actually build functional interfaces and build them into ourselves. The wearable computers that we began by discussing are something that is not built in. It's just something that you put on for the day and carry with you.
Yeah. Glenn, it was great having you back on the show again.
Nice being here.
Yeah.
Keep up the good work.
We shall do that, and thank you.
You're welcome.
We've just been listening to Glenn Heemstra. He's the visiting scholar at the Human Interface Technology Lab at the University of Washington and also founder of Futurist.com. Now, please stay with us, because if you want to find out about how technology is changing the face of the elections that are coming up in America, you got to hear what John Heilman has to say. He's an author and Business 2.0 writer, and he'll elaborate on his recent story called Rewiring the War Room that was in the April 2004 issue. This is Web Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Greenlee of Web Talk Radio. I've got a tip for you. If you're looking to register a new domain name or get a new website hosted, then support the Web Talk Radio show by visiting web.com. They have been a trusted name on the web for years and have had over 300,000 customers over the years. They specialize in domain name registrations and hosting, but they have a domain name registration as low as $4.95 per year, and that's for a yourname.web.com domain name. And they also have regular .com domain names for $6.95 per year. Web.com was recently ranked number one by tophosts.com and CNET certified as being a top web hosting provider. Their hosting plans are as low as $7.95 per month, and that's even for an online e-commerce solution. So trust me, Web.com is a great place to get your solution, and you can give them a call at 1-800-761-2468. That's 1-800-761-2468, or just visit them right on their website at web.com.
Come on! We'll be right back.
We're back with Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and thanks for joining us again. The Howard Dean presidential campaign proved that the web and blogs have changed the way politicians raise money and reach voters at the grassroots level, but the use of more technology like wireless networked databases are making the 2004 presidential campaign go high-tech with terms like CRM and micro-targeting and reaching voters using regional and local information to better craft the campaign message. Business 2.0 magazine columnist John Heilman will tell us about how technology and the internet will continue to impact election 2004 and the high-tech political arms race that's been set into motion. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
You just wrote an article in the April issue of Business 2.0 about how information technology and the internet and blogs are making the 2004 presidential campaign kind of a new era in politics. So why don't you kind of explain kind of the premise of your article, and are these changes good for our political system?
Well, I mean, I'll try to reserve any kind of normative judgment on good or bad. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing, you know, that the column that I wrote is about a guy named David Rosenthal, who was the political director at the AFL-CIO for a number of years and did a lot of really important work there in terms of getting labor to be a kind of revived, kind of rejuvenated political force. And the thing that Rosenthal did was, when he was there at the AFL, was to say, you know, television advertising is really turning everybody off.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to take politics back to the future. I want to go back to the kind of 19th century ideal. I think I can be more effective by focusing on grassroots, on mobilization, on getting voters to register, and then on getting voters to turn out for my candidates,
mm-hmm.
by actually talking to them and by trying to pinpoint those people in a more kind of precise individual way. So that was basically, for him, it was the rebirth of, you know, door-to-door, knock on people's doors, figure out what issues they care about. I mean, get in a conversation with the voter rather than just screaming at them over the television. And what he discovered in the course of that time at the AFL-CIO was that new technology could really aid in that process enormously. He now is the head of this group called America. He left the AFL-CIO after the 2000 campaign, and now he runs this group called America Coming Together, which is one of these new political action committees that's been formed in the wake of the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Act.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably heard about George Soros, the billionaire financier, mm-hmm. giving a lot of money to groups that are associated with the Democratic Party to uh-huh. try to win this election and beat George Bush.
Yeah.
The main group that Soros donated money to is this group, Rosenthal's group. He gave them $10 million, and they've since then raised like another $30 or $40 million and are probably going to try to raise another $40 or $50 million before the election. And they're taking all that money, and instead of putting it, you know, into television advertising, and there are other Democratic groups that are doing that, they're taking all that money and putting it into high-tech voter mobilization.
Oh,
and
interesting.
That's we can go into some detail about what exactly that they're doing, but essentially they're taking, you know, they're launching what is effectively the best funded, most sophisticated, and most technologically enabled grassroots organizing effort in the history of presidential politics. The Republicans are doing this also, by the way, on their own side, but this column at least focused just on Rosenthal.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how they're doing that a little bit. There's this whole term that you're using as micro-targeted database information. What are they doing there, and how are they gathering that information where they can actually get out there in the field and be specific about campaign politics, basically?
Right. So there are basically, as probably you and most of your listeners know, there are, you know, a relatively small number of states that people think are up for grabs. There's mm-hmm. 17 or 18 of them that the campaigns like to call the battleground states.
Mm-hmm.
And more particularly, there are four or five that they really think are going to be probably decisive in the election because the electorate is so polarized right now, and there's such a small number of undecided voters out there. Finding who those voters are really matters a lot. And also mm-hmm. finding voters who are your voters and making sure that they actually are mobilized and enthused about the election and getting them out to the polls really matters a lot.
Yeah.
The key states for both Republicans and Democrats are Pennsylvania, Ohio, Missouri, and Florida. So they're spending a lot of their time in those particular states. And the first thing that they want to do is there's always been voter rolls, you know, information that's been stored on databases that the parties have had for a long time
mm-hmm.
that, you know, talks about who's registered. And you could always, before, you could break down by like census tract or
oh, okay.
by community or by city. Mm-hmm. Now that information is getting more and more granular. So you're getting, you know, block by block data about people, what they're voting, who's registered, what mm-hmm. their voting history is, what their party preference has been, and what their demographic status is. So there are those data sets that are all being kind of put into these kind of centralized databases. And as your listeners probably know a little bit about the technology XML, mm-hmm. which has allowed the parties to do something they never used to be able to do, which was to take incompatible data types from all these different databases and actually munge all that data together. So now they have a much more nuanced kind of granular view of who's out there and who the people are that are the best and most likely targets for this kind of door-to-door outreach effort. And they've sent out, you know, these thousands of kids with Palm, you know, handheld computers with custom software mm-hmm. and sometimes actually even with little tiny media players. And they go door to door, knock on the doors of the people that they think might be persuadable, ask them a few questions, try to talk to them, try to find out what they care about, enter that information back into the system. And then that system gets synced back up to a web-based voter file system that allows them to not only have all this information, but also because they want to talk to these people not just once, but consistently over the course of the election as the campaign plays out. So you have not only the database, but then the information that you're collecting, and you're able to track those voters and what they're saying to you over time. And that gives you, you know, a really kind of powerful tool for being able to, you know, see whether you're persuading these people and moving them closer and closer towards your column, and whether, you know, whether they're someone that you want to then spend money on later on mm-hmm. to actually show up at their house on election day with a car and say, we're going to take you to the polls, right?
Okay.
So that's a kind of really refined, high-tech way of doing what traditional voter turnout has been. On top of that, these guys are going to the next level. You mentioned micro-targeting, which the article kind of talks about. Micro-targeting is the next wave of this, which they're just starting to kind of tip their toe in the water in this campaign around it. But, I mean, I say in the column that I think that, you know, it really is the future of political media. Mm-hmm. And micro-targeting is taking all of that data that we were just talking about and then layering on top of that data all of the stuff that commercial marketing knows about people, mm-hmm. right? So we know that, you know, that there's all the stuff that, you know, every magazine you subscribe to, you know, any civic associations you're part of, all the stuff that data mining companies now look at.
Psychographics, you know, all those kind of things.
Right, yeah, psychographic data. They mm-hmm. want to know, you know, we want to know if we put all the data about consumer commercial data together with the political data, you start to get very sophisticated models for, like, if a 42-year-old suburban mother with two kids who drives a Volvo and reads House and Garden, not so much is she a Democrat or is she a Republican, though that's important, but what issues does that woman likely to care about? I mean, mm-hmm. is that woman likely to be very amenable to a pitch about environmental protection, for instance, you know? Mm-hmm. And as they analyze this data and are doing lots of phone polling and lots of more of this door-to-door canvassing, you start to be able to get, I mean, not just a data set that boils down to here's a promising census block or here's a promising block of a neighborhood to focus on, but mm-hmm. literally being able to micro-target down to the individual. You know, mm-hmm. we know that you, Joe Blow, who lives at 3245 Hamden Lane, is someone who, given your past voter history, what you buy, what your family size is, what your ethnic background is, you know, what your income status is, all that stuff, you in particular is someone that we need to get to your house. And if you think about politics as all being like with regular commercial mm-hmm. marketing, it's all about cost efficiency. I mean, you can have a lot of money, but in the end, you know, you have a finite amount of money. And the question is, how effectively can you spend it, the time and the money, you know, to produce, you know, the closest ratio of dollar to vote is what you're looking for. So to the extent that you can weed out as many unlikely people and focus all of your time on the likeliest people that you can bring to vote for your side, mm-hmm. you're successful. And these guys are doing, you know, are using the, you know, the abilities of the data mining technologies and the web to be able to, you know, take this political process to this very, you know, this exquisitely finely tuned, intensely targeted mode of political communication and persuasion.
They're gathering all this data on what voters want to hear, basically, and probably working towards trying to craft that message that's specific to that particular focus area. that's probably the first stage. What needs to be developed next is how do you actually get that message to that person? I would think is the next stage.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there are a couple things that are true. I mean, one thing, what they think about when they think about the way in which all these technologies come together for them, it's interesting. Democrats and Republicans are a little bit different in terms of the way that they think about voters. I mean, Republicans tend to think about voters a lot more in terms of values.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats tend to think of voters a lot more in terms of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats really believe, I mean, the Democratic political professional class really believes that, you know, that if you find out what one or two issues a voter cares about most and focus on those and find voters who are obviously on, you know, that are amenable to your stance on those issues,
that's
the most effective way to get them to vote for your side. So what they're thinking of, the technology to them is, what they're trying to build is a label generator. You know, mm-hmm. if we can figure out a way to put all this technology and we can slap a label on your forehead
that tells us
what matters to you, that's the first step. And the second step is the media side of it, right? Which is the first thing is what Rosenthal discovered, you know, in his time at the AFL-CIO was, you know, basically sort of three things about persuasion was, you know, was first that, you know, they sound really basic, but, you know, one is that, you know, is this thing about building campaigns around issues. The second is that you want to try to contact people as close to where they live as possible. You know, you don't want to get paid voter banks with anonymous guys calling up on the phone. What you want to do is you want to meet people face to face at their house or where they work. You know, and the third thing is you contact them a lot. You develop a relationship with them. It's like, you know, relationship marketing, or, you know, you want to have a conversation. And so
frequency is important in any kind of marketing campaign. Yeah.
And you think to yourself, you know, I think a lot of people think to themselves, when I've said this to various people talking about the column and about these ideas, people say, man, you know, I wouldn't want some guy showing up at my house. You know, I mean, I don't want that. You know, that sounds annoying and obnoxious. And it turns out that, you know, most of us are a little bit in the minority on this thing. I mean, actually, I mean, there are many people, obviously, who just slam the door in people's faces because they've already made up their mind. Among the people who are likely to actually vote who haven't made up their mind, they're actually pretty curious, and they want to have that conversation, it turns out, and they're open to being persuaded. They're not, you know, they're not the door slammers, and those are obviously the people that the politicians care about. The media side of it is, you know, if you know, you know, that in a largely black neighborhood in Cleveland, that there's a bunch of young blue-collar black workers in a particular neighborhood who can be moved on a particular set of issues. You know, one of the things they're doing is they've got, like, Hollywood producers, like, you know, working with Russell Simmons to produce issue ads that are, you know, focused on urban neighborhoods so that the ads can be presented almost literally to the person at their door. It's like you're going to the person, knocking on the door, having the conversation, then saying, okay, you know, I want you to look at this now. You know, this isn't just an ad that we might get you to see if you happen to be watching the right station at the right time. Here's this piece of hip-hop driven Russell Simmons or Chuck D featured in the ad. Look at this. And they're like on a little individual media player. They're saying, here, look at this ad right now and tell us what you think about this ad. Yeah. So it closes the ad seems really tailored to them. And it feels really immediate, and you're also able at that moment after they watch the ad, literally in the presence of this outreach worker, they're able to get feedback from that, and all that information that gets synced back up into the web, so they can then retailer the media. If they discover something that works, something that doesn't work, they can then, you know, further refine the message.
We're in the middle of a conversation with John Heelman. He's the Business 2.0 columnist that just wrote a story, Rewiring the War Room, about the presidential campaign and technology. More in a moment with this Web Talk Radio.
Hey, radio lovers, you can now record thousands of radio stations, listen anywhere you want, and even fast forward over the fluff. How? With Replay Radio. It's easy to use and incredibly cool. Replay Radio turns your PC into a VCR for the radio. To listen, just use your PC, MP3 player, iPod, or car CD player. So what are you waiting for? Try a free demo right now. Visit the Replay Radio website today at replay-radio.com.
Hi, this is Rob Greenlee of Web Talk Radio. I've got a tip for you. If you're looking to register a new domain name or get a new website hosted, then support the Web Talk Radio show by visiting web.com. They have been a trusted name on the web for years and have had over 300,000 customers over the years. They specialize in domain name registrations and hosting, but they have a domain name registration as low as $4.95 per year, and that's for a yourname.web.com domain name. And they also have regular .com domain names for $6.95 per year. Web.com was recently ranked number one by tophosts.com and CNET certified as being a top web hosting provider. Their hosting plans are as low as $7.95 per month, and that's even for an online e-commerce solution. So trust me, web.com is a great place to get your solution, and you can give them a call at 1-800-761-2468. That's 1-800-761-2468, or just visit them right on their website at web.com. You're still connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Web Girl Dana's here.
And John Heelman is with us. He's talking about how technology will change the 2004 elections.
It certainly seems like it would work well for television and radio from a kind of a geographic or regional focus as far as with the media, but it seems like that the opportunity really is online, I would think, to craft personalized messages. I know there's a big trend like with Google and the search engines to do localized search and localized information. It seems like this is a perfect match for that, where the candidate can craft the message to a particular zip code or something like that.
Right.
And so when a person logs on maybe to their website, the information that comes up on the candidate's website is specific to that location.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the next step. Certainly the success of the Dean campaign early on in raising a lot of money over the internet was the first time, I think, the fourth or fifth presidential election that I've covered in one way or the other.
Wow.
And it's the first time that I've seen people in politics really taking the internet seriously.
Mm-hmm.
In 96, no one really took it seriously. In 2000, there were press people who were from the internet, but as a tool for politics, the internet and the web now seem to be taken seriously. And the first thing that really made people realize it, as with a lot of things in life, both in the business world and politics, is money. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you see a tool that's being able to attract, you know, as an organizing tool and as a fundraising tool, the Dean campaign really awakened a lot of people to the notion that, right, okay, this is a medium that's actually permeated a lot of voters' consciousness, and it's something that we can use. And I think you'll see, you know, increasingly, as the web gets more sophisticated mm-hmm. in the ways that you were just talking about, and as the political people get more sophisticated right in step with the abilities of what the technology allows you to do,
sure.
2008 will be, you know, the year where a lot of that really, really targeted media, and particularly a lot of targeted web-based media, comes to the fore. Interestingly, you know, the column I'm doing next is a column about this guy named Mark McKinnon, who's the head of the Bush advertising team.
Mm-hmm.
And without going into a lot of detail about that column, which is really about the role of advertising in a fragmented webified, you know, media landscape.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I didn't really realize this, but he said to me, you know, that they had done the very first Bush ad that came out in this election campaign. They broadcast that piece of advertising on the web and never played it on television.
Oh, interesting.
And the point of it was not necessarily, first of all, obviously it's incredibly cost effective, and they were able to do a longer form piece of advertising rather than like a 30-second spot or a 60-second mm-hmm. spot. They could do like a 3 or 4 minute biographical thing that was almost mm-hmm. like a little mini movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they got, you know, you had a lot of people, an incredibly large number. I can't remember exactly what the number is, but an incredibly large number of people actually looked at the ad on the web, which really opened their eyes to that. And secondly, of course, they got a lot of press attention
mm-hmm.
for having done that. And it's the first time that that's ever happened, really. I mean, there have been ads that have run on the web before, but, you know, to really kick off your advertising campaign with a web-based thing is, you know, is new.
Well, yeah, I think, if they were doing that type of a video, it's probably less a commercial and more of a, you know, it's a documentary type of a format where it's not a commercial message. It's really something that you would watch to find out more information about the candidate, I would think.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So it seems like that could be really a powerful way for media to be used in the future, and I think we're going to see more of that. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, and it's powerful, and it's powerful because I mean the thing that we you know, again, it's a matter of critical mass. It's now got to the point where in both of these areas, in terms of turnout and in terms of media, the web is now sufficiently widespread and used to a large enough degree that it makes sense in terms of cost effectiveness to actually go and do stuff on it. And also broadband is a huge deal. You know, a lot a lot of stuff you couldn't do 4 years ago, you can now do. And as you say, I mean, I think that that personalization and localization of web content that is not quite here. I mean, it's a little bit here, but it's not really completely here. But that will clearly be something that will be emerging really rapidly over the course of the next, you know, over the course of the next 4 years.
Well, and thinking back to your article, too, you mentioned something about CRM models that, that really a lot of what's going on here is tools have been used in business for years.
Right.
And it's just now being picked up by the political campaigns. And, you know, the whole term CRM really should be flipped on its head now when you apply to campaigns. It, it should be VRM for voter relationship marketing is what
right.
I was thinking. Because it's really the same kind of thing, I think, is really what you're talking about here.
Yeah, well, it's, it is about, like I say, I mean, it's, it, it is back to the future. And it's,
yeah.
It's the sense of back to the future in the sense of, you know, in, you know, 100 years ago, in at least in our idealized conception about how politics worked in America then, before media, you know, before, not before media, but before the electronic media, you know, the way that it was a conversation. I mean, it was much more of a conversation. It was much more about, you know, door-to-door mobilization, whistle-stop tours by candidates, you know, and it was not a, it was, you know, it was not a completely, you know, top-down broadcast age kind of methodology, which is what it became once you got television in the picture. And you can see now that it's going to go back. I mean, the trend is television now is part of the mosaic. You know, we can't not put television on, but the television is really just one component of what some of these guys call the big microphone, you know, and the web is a larger and larger part of that. And you talked about the thing about the, about commercial marketing. I mean, you hear that in commercial marketing all the time now, right? Especially in the most forward-looking areas of commercial marketing, that the technology allows you to engage in a conversation with your customer. You know, it's really, you know, relationship marketing is what is what it's about. And it's inevitable in every political kind of evolution of political communication over the past, you know, 100 years, the business people actually always get it first. They're out there on the leading edge of media, and then the political people are a little bit behind. And that adoption of business techniques into politics is, you know, is traditional. It happens, you know, you can watch it. You could see how it happened from the original direct mail thing. You know, direct mail was in the commercial sphere 6, 8, 10 years before direct mail became a really big deal in politics. And television advertising, same deal, you know, and now the CRM thing is a good example. It's exactly the same thing. As you say, VRM is actually pretty good.
Sites like meetup.org, ones that create conversation and meetings and use the internet as a aggregation point for conversation about politics, I think is another huge area for politics.
Well, that's, I mean, as I, to hark back to the Dean campaign again, I mean, it's, you know, it's the organizing. If you think about politics as being three things, you know, it's organizing people, raising money, and persuading people to vote. And the Dean campaign did two of those really well. And Meetup, you know, was really at, obviously at the core of that. Move On is a much, is more, you know, ideologically based. But again, but they're about community in some sense. I mean, they're about trying to create communities, and it turns out that online is a pretty good way of doing that. And it's especially a good way of doing it for people who are in a country where half the people don't vote. You know, it's a really, it's a pretty good way to organize and reach people who are engaged.
And
that's important. That's really important.
Yeah,
you know, you're again, it, when you're thinking about cost effectiveness, you know, you want to try to be the most, the best thing to find is, you know, a voter who is undecided but really wants to vote.
Yeah, who knows? It might get more voters out, especially if we can get through the technology and figure out how to do voting online, where people don't actually have to mail something in or go to you know, a voting poll location, that they can actually do it more conveniently, maybe even from their television set at some point.
Yeah, I think isn't it true? I think that the Indian election this there's an Indian presidential election that's going on right now. I think they vote in stages, but they're doing the first. You know, it's the biggest exercise in democracy in the world, and I think it's going to be the first electronic one. Any place. I mean, there are obviously this whole subject for a whole different conversation.
Yeah,
there are obviously
lots
of problems around a lot of problems on the technology side and the security side around that. But again, it's clearly the wave of the future, and you know, we won't see it in 2004. But I'd be really surprised if by 2008 or maybe the next one after that, if we're not pretty much all doing. You know, the voting process has become completely electronic.
Yeah. Well, John, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's great to speak with you and get your thoughts on all this because it's really important and timely.
Well, I'm always happy to ramble on about politics.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
We've been speaking with Business 2.0 magazine columnist John Hillman, and you can read his article, Rewiring the War Room, in the April 2004 issue of Business 2.0 or online at business2.com.
Thank you very much for listening to WebTalk Guys this week. That's it for our show this week, but Rob and I will be back here bringing you more glimpses into the future of the Internet.
Thank you for downloading the WebTalk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same WebTalk Guys time, same WebTalk Guys channel.